The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series. The speaker is Mark Nunberg, guiding teacher at Common Ground.
A big welcome to everyone, all those of you online, all the folks in the room, and also all the people listening later on dharmaseed.org, where we keep all of the audio talks at Common Ground, and also on our YouTube channel watching the recorded live stream at some later time. It's just nice to have a sense of the bigger community. You know, we're no longer just COVID and the pandemic sort of has created all kinds of reverberations that we collectively don't yet understand. Hopefully they're not all bad. But one of them is our community has really changed. I mean, we have folks that show up, but we also have folks in town that don't show up, and we have folks around the country and maybe probably even outside of the country showing up for programs now. And we draw strength, actually, from connection. I'm sure you know that, but we tend to forget it until we don't have connection. And then we go, oh yeah, that was helpful. Not that it's ever pretty or perfect, you know, it's not community connection, but it's generally speaking harder without it. And it's just nice in terms of our practice because, like the study that we've undertaken these last few weeks, and it will probably take us a couple of months to get through the Buddhist teachings on the three characteristics, it's generally called. And it's there are three skillful perceptions that we cultivate. And it's functional. When we cultivate perceptions of change and unsatisfactoriness and impersonal nature, it can sound a little off-putting, but the question is to ask and to look functionally. When I train my mind to perceive, to connect through those lenses of change, unsatisfactory. Remember, unsatisfactory doesn't mean that an experience is painful. It just means that it won't ultimately satisfy me. You know that existential restlessness, uneasiness? Nothing really seems to quench that. I mean, we've tried through drink and entertainment and through lots of wholesome means too. But it doesn't really address that. In Buddhism we call it dukkha, the deeper experience of uneasiness or stress, or even you could use the word suffering. So they're meant to be ways of showing up, and then just to check, does it allow me to be clearer? Does it allow me to be more, to respond in more skillful, appropriate ways when I'm aware of that? And how about when I'm doing the opposite and I'm imagining I'm seeing, experiencing something that's permanent and something that is ultimately satisfying and something that's ultimately about me? What does that set in motion when we're perceiving that way? That's actually easier to notice, right? Because it clearly, I mean, you can check for yourself. Does it really help for me to say it? But it seems to me it makes us tight when I'm imagining things are permanent. Because when I imagine things are permanent, then I feel justified in protecting it because it can really, you know, be there for me in some kind of lasting, meaningful way. It will satisfy me because it is permanent. So the happiness we have because we're healthy, or we have a nice, healthy relationship going on with somebody or many folks, right? Then it just evokes a justification for clinging and grasping, making something a refuge that isn't really a refuge, isn't a trustworthy refuge. Not that it's bad, but it isn't a refuge. And because we're mistakenly thinking things are refuges that aren't, we're not actually curious about, well, what might be a trustworthy refuge for this human life. For those of you who want to stay for the small groups at the end, both here in person and online, Lucy is here to organize small groups for those of you on Zoom today. But you could do it with somebody at home later in the week or whenever, or just contemplate in your own mind. But another angle on impermanence that we've touched on but haven't really dug into as much is, what does the perception of impermanence give me? How does it support my life? And just to be curious about that. Like Thich Nhat Hanh, some of you know, a well-known teacher who died this last year, said something like, long live impermanence, it makes everything possible, right? Like all of us. Otherwise, our mothers would still be pregnant. But there's an end. Yeah. So we don't realize it isn't just that things cease. Saturday ceased. It does not exist anymore. But the cessation of Saturday allowed Sunday to burst forth. Oh, Sunday. You know. So to just bring it in and notice what happens when we start embracing and aligning with change. So if we've got, like I have, I think I've mentioned over the last few weeks, just some bodily pain. And but, you know, it helps knowing that probably it will change. Of course, I don't know how it will change. It could get worse. But things just keep unfolding. It isn't like, this isn't like, what is that play, Beckett's play, Waiting for Godot, you know, the sort of endless loops. Nothing ever changes. I mean, it's a nightmare for us, actually. We think, God, I'd like things to be permanent, but that would be the real hell. And just the dynamic nature, you know, like oppression isn't a fixed entity, however you might be experiencing it or the world might be experiencing it. Things change. And it's really nice because you see how it evokes a greater willingness to participate and show up in our partnerships, in our families, in our world, only because we know that it matters, because things change, and they change depending on how we show up, how we relate, what we contribute or don't contribute. Like, I mean, even the fact that this center and our retreat center, the community exists, I mean, it's just like a perfect example of change. For those of you who have, you know, relatively healthy, happy families, that bursted forth, right? It was a perfect expression of change. And, of course, the other side of it is our ancestors have passed away. And we're in the process of birth, aging, and death, right? It's just the nature of things. Winter is becoming spring. Spring will become summer. Pema Chodron, I put this in the document. So those of you online, remember, it's in the chat. And I'll put it in again one more time for anybody who joined late online. And people in the room, if you go to the Sunday morning program on our public calendar online, you'll see a Google Doc with all these articles, the links to these articles, including one by Pema Chodron. She's a really wonderful teacher in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, a Westerner, and a Buddhist nun. And the article is "The Fundamental Ambiguity of Being Human: How to Live Beautifully with Uncertainty and Change." And it was published in Tricycle, although I'm guessing it was from one of her books that they just excerpted on. But anyway, she asked the question, is it possible to increase our tolerance for instability and change? And what does this look like in our lives? So if you do stay for small groups, you could just talk about places in your life where you have embraced change, like maybe raising a child, and you're at that state, or your child's at that state, where they're not just a cute little kid anymore, whether they ever were or not completely a cute kid, but they're starting to manifest sort of teenage qualities, right? Things are changing. And just to, like, how we can be in denial, but how we can really embrace the ambiguity of the situation. Are they a baby? Or are they a scheming pre-adult? You know, what are they? And just the same with anything, like, you know, the United States. Are we a democracy? Are we sort of moving into a new phase at something beautiful and less oppressive? Or we go, you know, we think sliding backwards toward, but it's like there's a ever ongoing tumbling forward. And so just to look at places in your life and share about places in your life, contemplate places in your life where you have a more honest relationship with change, and places in your life where you can't go there yet for whatever reasons. Like, that's not okay. I don't feel comfortable seeing, relating to this part of my life with that lens, that way of like seeing change, seeing that it's unfixed, it's not certain, whatever it is unreliable, it's in motion. And that motion we call in Buddhism conditionality, meaning it's not just independent motion, like my own trajectory through my life, birth, aging, and death, or the greater swirl of our community. It's, we say, interdependent. Everything depends on everything. The image, a really simplistic image used at the time of the Buddha, is like stacks of reeds, you know, or even wheat, you know, you harvest, you tie it up, and then you'd lean them against each other. And he used that image like, if you remove one, the whole thing falls down. So whatever this is, you know, as we're living this conditional experience, it depends on everything else. So it's this complex, we can't, that's the sort of the deeper understanding of change, or would be with words like uncertain and unreliable and ungovernable too. Because things aren't certain or fixed or permanent. And the interesting thing is we think that's a problem. Here, I'll just read this passage from Pema Chodron's article. I'm just read a couple sentences from different paragraphs. So what does it feel like to be human in this ambiguous, groundless state? For one thing, we grab at pleasure and try to avoid pain, but despite our efforts, we're always alternating between the two. It's like trying to get comfortable, you know? We're never quite there. And then when we get close, we have to pee, or we want a hot beverage, and then we have to, or the cat wants to come in or go out, or, you know, so we don't actually get there. And even if we're there, like even if you really get to your sweet spot, how long does it last before the body gets stiff and it wants to move? I had that this morning. We went to bed pretty early last night, my spouse and I, and so there I was, you know, I don't know, it was like 4 or something, and I had enough sleep. I was like, but I don't want to get up. It's only 4 o'clock. Usually I get up, you know, 5 or 5:30. And it's just like, I'm, you know, it's that kind of rebellion. You can't make me get up. It doesn't matter that I was uncomfortable lying in bed. It wasn't satisfying. But it's that, like, that wanting that permanent routine. This is, as opposed to like getting up at 5 or 5:30, that's an uncertain thing. Or anything that, you know, we want to lock down. And then a little later, Pema Chodron writes here, but it is not permanent per se, or even knowing that we're going to die, that is the cause of our suffering, the Buddha taught. Rather, it is our resistance to the fundamental uncertainty of our situation. Our discomfort arises from all of our effort to put ground under our feet. To realize our dream of constant okayness, when we resist change, it's called suffering. But when we completely let go and not struggle against it, when we can embrace the groundlessness of our situation and relax into its dynamic quality, that is called enlightenment, or awakening to our true nature, to our fundamental goodness. Another word for this is freedom. Freedom from struggling against the fundamental ambiguity of being human, right? So there is the fundamental ambiguity of being human, and the stress we encounter so much of the time, the anxiety, is because we think it shouldn't be the way it is. Fundamentally ambiguous, uncertain and unreliable and groundless in that sense. Where does this arrogant certainty come from that it shouldn't be this way? But isn't that a common background belief? It shouldn't be this way. This isn't okay. And it's true that it's in that sense that there are injustice or there's suffering, or that from this kind of normal egoic point of view, I don't like the fact that I'm exposed to things happening that I don't like. Right? That's all understandable, but it doesn't mean it's helpful to resist something that is, right? So if things are ambiguous and uncertain and unreliable and changing, what is the functional, skillful way to be relating to that? And can we do that? And what happens when we do that? What's the result of that? And a lot of the ways that we resist change, or just the nature of things, the unfolding, changing nature of things, the way we actually create ground more than probably any other way is we attach, get identified with fixed views, fixed opinions, fixed beliefs. Because it, like even including about who I think I am or who I think you are, because that's how we create ground all the time. But we can actually do this in our own practice, our own contemplation, like take any fixed idea you have about yourself, about another, about the world, and just look at it for what it is. Like, what is that idea? Not intellectually, conceptually what that idea is, but what is it subjectively to have the idea, like, let's just take something simple. I live in Minneapolis. That's an idea, right? It kind of gives, it can superficially give us a sense of ground. At least I can name where I live. You know, I live over there. Not here, over there to the east. In Minneapolis, not across the river, right? So we have all these, you know, and I can even put a time element. I moved here in 1993. I grew up here, but I moved away and then I moved back in 1993. So I've lived here since 1991. So, a little fuzzy. But the thing is, when with awareness and wisdom, we notice the mind creating ground by telling a story, even a story that there's some consensual buy-in, like no one's going to necessarily argue with me about my story. But still, what is it in my mind when I think that I live in Minneapolis? I mean, that thought is like so amazingly ephemeral. Does it actually provide ground? Or I'm this kind of person. You know, I'm white, or I'm straight, or I'm older now, or, you know, still young, or whatever sort of words, adjectives we'd use to sort of build something that we would cling to, what does it really give us? And so when Pema Chodron talks about embracing the fundamental unavoidable ambiguity of our being, of our lives, the question is, does it have that taste of freedom? And if it does, are we willing to take care of ourselves because of compassion? Okay. And is it stressful to try to find, to live with ground when it's all endlessly constructed? That's the trouble with whatever kind of ground we've put together for ourselves. One of the things we can notice with wisdom and awareness is that we're endlessly patching it up, whatever story we're clinging to. But there's something about embracing change and the ambiguity, like we're learning as we're living our lives to sense that free fall quality in the moment. And again, it's not contrived. We're not imposing that view on things. We're using the idea of change, or like the word free fall, fluid, flux. We're using those kinds of words almost like we're letting them affect how we perceive the moment, how we sense things, and see if it allows for a more accurate, a more intimate, a more in line way of being with experience, with the moment. And then we can look just on that ethical level, like how we're showing up, how we're responding, the kind of person we are. Like, does it lead to more regret and remorse? Or does it lead to a kind of wholesome self-esteem, like being able to value non-harming in a deeper way? This is from from the Buddhist tradition, this teaching. There's different versions of this, so it may not sound like some of the versions you've heard. This existence of ours is as transient as autumn clouds. To watch the birth and death of beings is like looking at the movement of a dance. A lifetime is a flash of lightning in the sky, rushing by like a torrent down a steep mountain. You know, it's kind of nice about, some of you know Clouds and Water Zen Center in St. Paul, wonderful Buddhist Zen Center. But that clouds and water, right? These images, these poetic images, like that's a very powerful metaphor or image of the ephemeral nature of things. Because it's not just a cloud, which is pretty ephemeral anyway, right? I mean, it's just vapor reflecting light, semi-transparent, right? And in motion, both in terms of like passing by, but even if you watch clouds, they also have movement within that general movement from, you know, generally for us, it's west to east, not always, of course, but then to see the cloud reflected in a pool of water, right? And the fluttering, you know, it makes it even like, but that's sort of the, you know, in different poetic ways at least, but in meaningful poetic ways, this is the advice, the encouragement we get from our Dharma ancestors. You know, I'm sure you've all heard about sensing this, the reflective nature of this, almost like a dream. And there's a really powerful image in the tradition, and it uses some of the yogic, mystical Hindu images. Indra, some of you know, is a sky god in that yogic, mystical tradition. And a little bit like, what's the Greek god that threw lightning? Was that Zeus? Yeah, it might be related to Zeus in some ways. But anyway, it's called Indra's net. And the idea that there's this infinite web, this is like a metaphor for existence or for reality. Infinite web, and each intersection of the web, and there are infinite number of those intersections, there's a perfect little jewel with an infinite number of faces on the jewel, like a perfect diamond. And each face is reflecting the totality, right? So you get, isn't that a nice image? It's like not much of anything, but it can seem so real, so rich. And this is a little bit what our Dharma teachers, ancestors are saying. Like, we have a very arrogantly strong idea, like especially in the West now, with the real fundamentalist belief in the West is materialism. And like, even though we know we have a mind, I mean, we could do a survey in this room. Most of us would conventionally respond to the question, well, where did the mind come from? By saying, well, we were once single cell creatures in the ocean, and through evolution we became more complex, and we've got this amazingly complex brain and consciousness, and what we call mind is just some arising out of the biology of the mind, of the physical brain, right? And nobody ever questions that, for the most part, this truth of materiality. So whenever we have a fundamentalist belief, there's pushback when people, you know, I mean, it's appropriate to have pushback if someone's saying you're wrong and this is right. But there shouldn't be pushback when somebody says, are you sure? And if you're not sure, what's it like to live your life knowing that you're not sure? And what does that allow in, knowing that we're not sure? And you know, a lot of the basic understanding from the East, like in the West, especially Western scientific, which, you know, dominates our culture, it's materialism is first, and the mind, what we call the mind, and what we would call self, comes out of the material. But generally in the East, you know, the general frame is all of what is what we call material arises out of the mind. Like a dream. Seems pretty material. I had a dream last night at the end when I didn't want to get up between 4 and 5. You know, the mind is forced to manufacture dreams, you know, doing as best it can. So it was like, I had a dream that my cat was caught by a dog. No. So where's the cat? Right, so that can seem very real. You know, the visual experience of that and the sounds that the mind was hearing and whatever else kind of made up that experience subjectively seemed very real. Like, this experience seems very real too, doesn't it? Yeah. So how do we know? It's like people roll their eyes when, I don't know, is it Elon Musk or some people up there think about, you know, really into the multiverse idea. I don't know if you heard that. I don't want to go into it. I don't know. But the one good thing about this isn't that that's right or not right, is to bring in some humility. So we're actually curious as opposed to certain. Because that's generally how we live. And the reason we gravitate towards certainty, fundamentalism, you can be a fundamentalist secularist, right? You don't have to, there's any number of ways to be a fundamentalist or fundamentalist atheist. But what's really going on subjectively when we observe our heart is the mind's trying to oppose the fundamental ambiguity with certainty. And it's always a stressful endeavor. And that's kind of our homework now, is to see the cost of having not fully embraced, integrated, relaxed with, open to the truth of change. The ambiguous, the uncertain, the ephemeral, the constructed. You know, we use that word conditional or codependent, but it's this experience that feels so real, so permanent, so personal, like a dream. I mean, that is such a powerful clue that our dreams have all those same attributes when we're dreaming. So, not to kind of try to figure it out, but to realize, I mean, it's sort of like bringing the mystery in. And then when we keep that in mind, we'll see that it affects the habit of identification and attachment when we realize that the world isn't permanent and personal and capable. The world of experience isn't permanent, personal, and capable of providing a me complete satisfaction. And it fundamentally shifts the heart's relationship to existence. I mean, we kind of take it as a given how we relate to existence, right? But we're sort of in this endless dance of unconsciously constructing our existence, and then unconsciously trying to extract something from experience and not getting what we're trying to get from experience, satisfaction, security. So we construct, mostly unaware, the next moment and try to extract. And so what we're left with is this ongoing uneasiness and stressfulness, because we're trying to do something that can't be done. We're trying to get something for somebody in a way that doesn't really exist in the way we think it does. So the Buddha's resolution of this basic existential problem of suffering is not telling us who we are, but giving us practices that help us align with the way it is. That's the resolution. And it's a lot of times we think, well, I don't want that world. But all we're doing is aligning with the world we've always had. We're not aligning with a different world. So we're just coming into balance, coming into intimacy. We're just, the only thing we're abandoning is understanding that's not in alignment with the way it is. What we call ignorance. Be on the lookout as we're looking at, you know, impermanence and unsatisfactoriness and impersonal nature, these three characteristics. These are skillful means, skillful perceptions that support greater intimacy with the way it is. And there's an interesting phrase in Buddhism, yatta bhuta, which generally gets translated something like, as it has come to be. But accordingly produced, as it has come to be. Right? So this experience, dependently arising as this, it has come to be, like the conditions that make this experience, my subjective experience, your subjective experience, one of them is ignorance. Like expecting things to be this way or wanting things to be this way. The different habits of perception. Like what we notice and what we don't notice. And one of the reasons we were so dependent on concepts is concepts create the illusion of permanence. like the example I gave earlier about Minneapolis, the word Minneapolis makes this seem more substantial, you know, when we could call it something. Or the Mississippi River, or whatever names that we give our things. My 60s. You know, like as if the 60s is a thing, right? But it's just an ongoing process, aging, right? It isn't a thing. And then when we understand this, the underlying reality as the way things have come to be, so this appearance, and that's a powerful, I mean, that's a provocative thing to just start including, like your body says, how you doing? And your response is, well, right now it appears, my experience to me, it appears to be like this. It's an appearance, right? But I know it's an appearance. It appears that I'm happy right now. It appears that I'm upset right now. Because that's, you see, it's actually more true that way, more in alignment with reality. And the other thing about that, when we say it appears like this now for me, is it wouldn't be such a incongruency if in the next moment I said, now it appears like this, right? We wouldn't have to impose consistency, because appearances can flip very quickly. Like an example that's played with a lot, even at the time of the Buddha, where they didn't have movies, they did have those little, they were probably not that common, but you know, we have a lot of similar pictures, but when you flip them, it looks like there's some motion, like a movie sort of. They did have those because it's mentioned in the suttas, in the discourses, how that gives an illusion of motion, right? But it's just a bunch of static pictures being, you know, brought to the eye moment by moment. But it's the same thing, like in a movie, we could be completely in the appearance that the film creates, but then the film could bust and the manager turns the lights on in the theater and it's a completely different reality, right? Or we could have the illusion of being healthy and then find out suddenly that we're not healthy, or something happened. One of our longtime leaders had a bad fall on Thursday, I think it was, you know, and had some bad breaks, bone breaks. And it's like things can change really quick. But it didn't see that. If we know that it's just an appearance, then like Joseph Goldstein, one of my teachers, would say, anything can happen anytime. And that's the other thing, like sort of living with that, integrating that truth. We can't really count on things to be this way or that way. So maybe I'll leave it here. And maybe I'll make a few announcements and then give people a chance to leave who don't want to stay for the small group.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.